From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. The Manchurian candidate, Mr. Smith, goes to Washington, the American president. There's a vast store of movies drawn from Hollywood's political imagination. As the real presidential campaign plays out, producer John McDonough reminds us of some of the more obscure films on the subject.
Running for office in America is an engaging mix of principles on parade and deals done behind closed doors. Perfect for Hollywood. Let's start with Theodore K. Blair.
Theodore K. Blair, a good American name, a good American self-made businessman,
but no good American showmanship.
A businessman without showmanship was the centerpiece of The Phantom President, which saw a presidential election as a show. It should be better remembered than it is. Released a month before the 1932 election, it's the only sound film ever made by Broadway's greatest showman, George M. Cohan. He played a double role. As Theodore Blair, Cohan was able, presidential, but boring. As Doc Varney, he was Blair's exact twin, but loaded with charisma. Together, they made a very considerable candidate. It was a story device revisited by Kevin Kline 60 years later in the film Dave. It also offered an observation on American elections that still resonates.
We're conducting a presidential campaign, not a musical comedy.
Ah, you're wrong, sweetheart. That's what the voters want.
What? A musical comedy presidential campaign.
To prove it, Cohan sang his acceptance speech to a Rodgers and Hart score.
She's a grand old flag, and don't let her drag.
If the Phantom President viewed politics as comic opera, Gabriel Over the White House saw it as a Wagnerian fantasy of an American strongman in power. Walter Houston was a tempting and populist presidential vision at a moment when desperation embraced fanaticism. A lot of the speeches sound quaint today, but some still have a familiar ring.
I propose to safeguard the homes of American citizens by a law to prevent the foreclosure of mortgages. I propose a national banking law which will protect our people's money in the banks.
Houston was as benevolent in his purposes as he was iron-fisted in his means. The message was, if you can't win power, take it.
Mr. President, this is dictatorship.
I think, gentlemen, you forget that I am still the president of these United States.
It is within the rights of the president to declare the country under martial law.
8 years later, Hitler and Tojo had half the world under martial law. In 1941, Frank Capra's Meet John Doe warned that with enough money and media power, it could happen in America, too. Gary Cooper's John Doe was an anonymous everyman who became symbol and leader to a network of John Doe clubs. But their earnest decency was politically naive. The hidden power pulling their strings was media baron D.B. Norton, a Napoleonic plutocrat with his own private SS corps. Norton had his own ideas about democracy.
These are daring times, Mr. Barrington. We're coming to a new order of things. There's too much talk been going on in this country. What the American people need is an iron hand.
You're right, that's true. You're quite right, D.B.
The John Doe clubs would become Norton's wedge into the White House. In one of the great drunk scenes, a well-snookered James Gleason told Cooper that he was mixed up with a fifth column fascist conspiracy.
All right, now supposing a certain unmentionable worm whose initials are D.B. was trying to use that to shove his way into the White House so he could put the screws on. What would you say about that, huh?
Nobody's going to do that, Mr. Connell.
And nobody did. But in 1941, no one was certain that they couldn't.
Well, Jim, what's the state of the Union?
After the war, Capra turned to more immediate election material. The race for the 1948 Republican nomination. State of the Union reveled in the smoke-filled room talk that no politician would dare speak publicly. Cynicism became a foil for sentiment in which the kingmakers, not the kings, had the power. GOP boss Adolph Manjou explained.
The people have darn little to say about the nominations. You've both lived in this country all of your lives. It's about time to get that through your heads. You're not nominated by the people. You're nominated by the politicians. Why? Because the people are too darn lazy to vote in the primaries. Well, politicians aren't lazy.
State of the Union was also fact masquerading as fiction. Spencer Tracy's Grant Matthews was actually based on Wendell Willkie, the Wall Street industrialist who had been the real Republican nominee in 1940. Capra's cocktail of fact and fiction not only looked back, it was prophetic, too. In the final scene, as Tracy reclaimed his integrity in the middle of a nationwide TV broadcast, the party bosses tried to shut him down.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Grant Matthews. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Cut him off! Cut him off!
Don't you shut me off, or I'm paying for this broadcast. Don't
sound familiar? 32 years later, probably the only man who remembered that scene was Ronald Reagan, who masterfully reenacted it in New Hampshire.
Would the sound man please turn Mr. Reagan's mic off for a moment?
There are students of American political history who will tell you that what Reagan did next put him into the White House.
I am paying for this microphone.
Speaking of movie moments come to life, remember Bill Clinton's big applause line in 1988?
In closing!
Who knew that it had been the work of George S. Kaufman and Charles MacArthur 40 years earlier in The Senator Was Indiscreet?
And now, in conclusion.
Here is a forgotten but canny satire that stumbled with uncanny precision into much of our political future. If the visions of dictatorship imagined in the 30s never materialized, this remarkable little film put its finger on a kinder and gentler subversion, marketing.
Boss, I was in the advertising business once, so believe me, if you can sell the American public the idea that one cigarette is different from another, that one toothpaste is better than another, you can sell them anything, even Mel Ashton.
William Powell's Mel Ashton was a senator whose incompetence was exceeded only by his ambition, which was to be president. The party boss dismissed it all until...
Would you be interested in the fact that I keep a diary? I've kept it every day now for something like 35 years. I put everything in it, but not everything.
Good satire imitates realism, then adds a silly twist of improbable imagination. After all, what politician would be foolish enough to put everything in a diary? Or on tape, or a camera phone?
Owning a nice little diary is like owning a nice little atom bomb. Even if you never do anything with it, it's a comfort just to know it's there.
When it blew up, parody prefigured prophecy and gave us a glimpse of Richard Nixon, Bob Packwood, Anthony Weiner, and a procession of all-too-real politicians to come, all to be hoisted on their own diaries.
You've got to resign.
Resignation is easy, of course. It's the practicalities that can be complicated.
How am I going to live?
The interest on your capital.
What capital?
You mean to say you've been in politics for 30 years and haven't any capital?
How did I know that income tax bill meant me, too?
There were other tart little political epigrams, too, still suitable for framing. On becoming a candidate.
I am not a candidate for the presidency. But...
On influence.
There's an old saying in my state, if you can't beat 'em, bribe 'em.
Mischief is nothing new in politics, of course. Plato noted it 2,500 years ago in Greece, which may make it the original sin of constitutional democracy. And no one has found more fun with political sin than Hollywood. For NPR News, this is John McDonough.